When you think back of the time that you grew up in, and when you were younger, whether that was the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, or whatever that may be, within that short amount of time, because really, relatively speaking, that is a short amount of time, when you think about whether it be 50 years ago, 60, 70, to now, you can probably look back and think, boy, it seemed to be a lot less complicated in times past, whether it be riding a horse or just going out and riding your bike and not telling your mom and dad where you were going for long periods of time and coming back, and that wasn't a big deal. I remember that was kind of the way it was. Just, hey, I'm running out the door, going to play out in the neighborhood, ride my bike, go play ragball with my friends, pop in for lunch, go do it, repeat, go out till sunset, you know, in the summer. And things seem to be fairly simple in some degrees. Now, one area where that has complicated life has definitely been technology. I think as technology and knowledge has advanced, it's brought about some really cool things and some great conveniences, but it's also complicated things to a certain degree as well. About a month ago, Mr. Harris, he sent me an email, and he said, I've got a few, what did he say in the email? Could you clarify a few comments that you made in the sermon? And I'm not sure if I understood what you were saying. Oh no. And so I opened up the link and click on the attachment, and in there it was me, but I was speaking in South Korean. It looked like my voice was actually the same. My lips were moving, my hand gestures. It was like seamless. It was flawless, and I thought, oh wow, it was AI technology. And boy, if things are not that complicated compared to what it will be, that's also a very strong possibility. So yes, with new technology, there are also some more complicated things to think about. In the 30s, the form of communication was radio, newspaper, telephone, and mail. And how many in here really look forward to getting the newspaper every morning? You know, some still doing that. Not too many others, you know, but I did have the newspaper sent to us. But a lot of it is now online, you know. But I enjoyed getting the newspaper. That was something we looked forward to. And the funnies section. You know, where's the funny section? And that was the humor. As you can tell, I didn't read it very much, but I tried every now and then. But you know, the forms of communication: radio, newspaper, telephone, and mail. In 1934, the first handset telephone was used by an independent phone company, and its official name was the round-based rotary dial monophone. Now, today, between internet, email, smartphones, video, and chat phones or apps for children. You know, children and adults have a vast array of methods for communication and sourcing information. And there's even a device that's out there that Apple's put out. It's called the Vision Pro. And you put on these goggles, a real sleek looking thing. You know, they're real bulky. I don't know, we'll see if this takes off, but you could be walking around with these goggles on looking like you just went skiing or something, but you're actually, it has like a TV built in. You know, you can watch YouTube as you're walking and trying to cross traffic or whatever, but you could be, you know, you could actually check your email, and it's all by air. You know, you hit a button, and so if you do see somebody with weird looking goggles on walking down the street and doing things in the air, it's normal. It's normal. It's where we're at, and you can just do that. But you know, when there was one video of an individual who said, "I'm going to try this. It says, you know, it's not that complicated." So he did this for 48 hours or 50 plus hours, where he's just going to leave this on constantly, and it looked like a very complicated life to live. There were some conveniences, but for the most part, it was very complicated. And I think, you know, more and more as things try to become more automated And with the technology boom and increase, I think it is going to complicate things even more than where we're at already. I think it's complicated sometimes just to use a public restroom, and you try to wash your hands and you need the water to come out, but it has a sensor. I mean, I'm spending lots of time waving, pushing the button. A little kid comes up and he waves real quick, water comes out, and I asked him, I said, "What? How did you do that?" And, you know, just wave. I tried. It finally came out, but I'm like, you know, this is some of the things that shouldn't be this complicated, but it seems like that's where we're at in society. So much of how we function today is interacting with new technology, and this increase in knowledge, not a godly knowledge, but a worldly knowledge. This past Thursday, there was a very large cell phone outage, and because the majority of the people do not have an old-fashioned landline, some were not able to make a phone call. So it puts us in a position where we, you know, we have all these conveniences, we have amazing amount of technology, and yet we're very vulnerable at the same time because technology fails. According to the Wall Street Journal, the FBI director says that China cyber attacks on U.S. Infrastructure is now at an unprecedented scale, something that we would want to pay attention to, be watchful of. But Christopher Wray warns that the pre-positioned malware could be triggered to disrupt critical systems in the U.S. And we know, we've read some articles on that. We understand they have the potential to do that. But their hacking could affect our water treatment plants, our electrical grid, our oil and natural gas pipelines, and even our transportation systems. So things are so intertwined with some complicated computer systems, it could really affect our world or disrupt our lives, and the effects could be devastating. But Daniel 12 and verse 4, it tells us that, you know, there will be the increase of knowledge. And it describes as the increase of knowledge and running to and fro. And it's a more complicated world that we live in today. People are certainly running to and fro. And knowledge is certainly increasing as well. And there are complications that come from that increased knowledge, especially the knowledge that's not a godly knowledge, but yet that keeps progressing. We live in a complicated world. And what's the solution? Is the solution backup to the backup plan? If we just had a backup to that plan, then that plan, or more troubleshooting, you know, what is the backup plan, or what is the real solution? Well, actually, it's a bit more of a simple solution than we might think, or that most in the world would believe in today, and that is we need God's intervention and the return of Jesus Christ. The perspective, though, is more on the complications and the solutions in this complicated world, the into the details of what we need to just keep going. But we really need the right solution, and that would be the return of Jesus Christ. Sometimes it is a matter of a change in reference, though, to understand that. You and I understand that really the solution is not in man and man's effort. The solution is in God's intervention. So we have the right frame of reference. We have a right understanding. With any project where there's a complicated situation and you need a solution, there has to be the right frame of reference. You could have a bolt and, you know, you're trying to thread that bolt in there and just won't go. You're looking at it and over again trying to thread that bolt, but that bolt isn't going. But you need a different frame of reference. You get a little closer, you get the right angle, and you notice, oh, well, there's a little piece of metal sticking out, and it's keeping me from threading it. You know, you take that, and now you can go ahead and thread that bolt. But, you know, sometimes unless you have the right frame of reference, you're going to have a gulf between the complicated situation and the solution. And that happens with so many aspects of life. Our world is a complicated place. Simple solutions to the problems all humans face, and simple solutions to those problems are rare. But if the solutions were simple, then the problems wouldn't be so challenging. Why is it sometimes difficult to visualize our way out of complicated scenarios? And there are many different complicated scenarios in this life where sometimes we can't hardly understand or see a way out of that situation. Well, part of that has to do with staying in that same frame of reference, not by choice. Because sometimes God does help us to see something, and we maybe choose to keep that frame of reference that we have. But that could also be called adapting or transforming to the world, if you will, in certain situations, kind of like the frog in the hot water. You know, there can be too much adapting, and that water keeps getting hotter and hotter. One of the most well-known songwriters in history is Bob Dylan, and he had that just smooth voice, wasn't it? Just so smooth. I don't think so. Bob Dylan kind of had a little nasally voice, but he wrote a song, "Times Are A-Changin'." And I'll quote a couple of verses from the song. It says, "Come gather round people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters round you have grown, and accept that it's soon you'll be drenched to the bone." He goes on to say, "If your time to you is worth saving, you better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are changing." Then he goes on to say, "The line is drawn, the curse is cast, the slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past, the order is rapidly fading." And it kind of reminds me of the frog in the hot water, almost an encouragement to, hey, learn to swim. Learn to swim and where you're at and keep that same frame of reference, because times are changing, you better learn to adapt. Well, that isn't necessarily the godly solution to man's problems, for sure. You can think back to Lot and his family, and God gave them a different perspective, and that was flee. That was leave, and this is your deliverance. In fact, I don't want you to look back on the prior frame of reference that you had. You better look forward and don't look back, and this is the deliverance that I'm providing. And we know that Lot's wife decided to keep her frame of reference, which was to look back to the city that she knew and maybe the city that she yearned for. She didn't accept the new frame of reference that God was providing, even though God made it very clear what his desire was for them. She didn't know why. She did know why, excuse me. She understood God knew or explained, and they understood why they were to leave Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, what about those who don't have a clear reference point? Maybe a one-dimensional reference point. Maybe they don't understand what to do in a situation. We pray for discernment, as was brought out in the sermonette. We need discernment. We want discernment. We want what God's will is in our life. And yet we are sometimes faced with challenges where we've cried out, we've gone to him over and over again. Sometimes you pray and fast multiple times and you think, what is the solution in this? What is the solution? But it's still not clear. It's like, what do we do? I guess you wait. Or, you know, maybe there is a different, you know, point of reference or frame of reference that I'm not understanding. Excuse me. Drop the water there, sorry. Most of you have probably heard of the New England Dark Days. The New England Dark Days was the darkest day in the American Revolution. Physically speaking, it was a very dark day. It's said to be that the day was so dark that a candle was needed to see anything outside in the noontime hours. The day was May 19th, 1780. The sun came up as usual, but the skies darkened over New England as far north as Portland, Maine, and as far south as New Jersey. The primary reason is alleged to be a combination of factors, that there was smoke because of forest fires, thick fog, and also a cloud cover. And so because of this, many, from their frame of reference and seeing the darkness and the sudden darkness, they believe that it was the end of time. And they were terrified. There was fear and there was panic. And many thought it was the end of the world. Men desperately prayed and women cried. Many left work and filled the churches for comfort. Children were sent home from school that day. And so from their point of view, this was catastrophic. Something big was happening. It was so dark that the animals couldn't tell the difference between the afternoon and nighttime. The chickens went to their roosts. The cattle returned to their stalls. The birds gave their night chirps, and the frogs sounding off as well. Could you imagine that, just being in that situation, and you think, what is going on? Even the animals believe something is not right here, or you know, what is going on? But it was their frame of reference at that time. They didn't have any other frame of reference. If they were to be able to hop into a helicopter and hover over and look down, they probably would be able to see, oh, that's forest fires. This is dense fog, and what's going on? You know, this. There's a solution. There's a different frame of reference. But they didn't have that frame of reference, so they were left in a period of darkness for a certain amount of time. We all have experienced dark days in life, I guess, where you don't understand. You pray for understanding. You pray for discernment. But maybe the answer is wait. Just wait, and you'll understand, or you'll see. Or you need a different frame of reference that you haven't understood yet. You know, sometimes a solution to a complicated situation is a matter of focus and a matter of moving the camera, so to speak, to change our frame of reference. You know, wouldn't it be nice if it was that simple all the time and it was easy to see that frame of reference, or the right frame of reference, to know what to do? But the thing about understanding what we have to understand, sometimes it's when God says it's time, and here is a new frame of reference for you. Sometimes God allows us to only see a one-dimensional frame of reference and not understand why. And that's difficult when we don't understand why. And our viewpoint is only to look up to God for understanding and pray for your will to be done. I'd like to look at four individuals for the rest of the time. Briefly, we'll cover their lives. But I'd like to start with the life of Joseph. These are individuals who did not have a large amount of reference points. And it was for a reason. They didn't know what that reason was, but they went through it. Well, let's start with the life of Joseph. And here we read and know of the story of Joseph very well. But have you ever stopped to put yourself in his shoes? You know, we know that his brothers were jealous. We also know that God had a plan for him to go to Egypt. And we understand why that was. We understand that he was using his brothers to help him get to the destination that he wanted to be. But Joseph did not know that at that time. But let's put ourselves in his shoes for a minute. Let's turn to Genesis 37 and verse 15. Genesis 37 and verse 15. No, he doesn't have a clue here. Of course, he just told his brothers about his dreams and dreams of greatness, I guess, that would be the conclusion. He was naive. He didn't think that would cause him to be jealous. And he was clueless. He was just out looking for his brothers. Genesis 37 and verse 15. And he would have been right at about 17 at this time. It says, "Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?' So he said, 'I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks.' And the man said, 'They have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan.' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. And when they came and saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. And they said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard, and he delivered him out of their hand and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to him, shed no blood, but cast him into the pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. Let's stop right here for a moment. What was Joseph's frame of reference? What was his viewpoint? Put yourselves in his shoes for a minute. Literally, all you can see is up and the sky that is there. And thinking about what was taking place, really, your thoughts are directed towards God. You don't understand what is taking place. All of a sudden, you realize your brothers hate you. If he realized his brothers wanted to kill him and or were going to sell him as a slave, do you think he'd be out there looking for him? He was very naive to the situation. Where's my brothers? And they wanted to kill him. He found him. So he's thinking, what's going on? Why did they do this to me? Did I share too much details about my dreams? Are they jealous of me because of my coat? Why would that make them jealous? At this point, you can hear the voices of your brothers perhaps arguing. What are they arguing about? Will they leave you there to die? Will they kill you themselves? What's taking place? This is a frame of reference, and it's a frame of reference only on the current situation and what is right in front of his eyes. It's not much of a reference point. Again, his reference point is basically looking up out of a pit. There's not much to understand or to gain. Yeah, I get this tickle in my nose almost every time I'm up here. I think it must be a dust thing. Oh well. Anyways, I'll try not to itch my nose too much, but oh, it's really it's terrible. I just have to take a minute. Okay. All right. I think there's definitely something here that I'm allergic to in this hall. But anyways, put yourself in his shoes for a minute. Think about him. Why does he have an itchy nose? No, it's very itchy. No. Put yourself in his shoes. Now let's look at a different example too, okay? Think about the life of Job. And again, this is one frame of reference in Job's life, but yet there are many things in the work in his life. Job suffered great loss, and it was because Satan was attacking. And yet he didn't curse God. He worshiped God instead. Satan wanted Job to curse God. He went to God and said, he will curse you. He'll curse you to your face. If you let me, you know, hurt him physically, he'll curse you to your face. Because he didn't, with the first loss and the losses that he had on that first time, and now he wants to hurt him physically. And his frame of reference was quite limited. But let's turn to Job 2 and verse 4. Job 2 and verse 4. So Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Well, let's stop for a moment here. What was Job thinking about? What could he see? What could he feel? What could he focus on? He might not have been able to focus on much because the pain was so intense. He's sitting on a pile of ashes to provide some sort of relief and comfort. A little bit of a cushion from the terrible pain from head to toe. Surely he was wondering, why is this happening to me? So many questions. Is God dissatisfied with me? Is he punishing me? If so, for what? How can I ask him for justice since I've not cursed him or accused him of wrong? Wouldn't death be more preferable than this? Let's move on to another example, that of Esther. The life that she knew was suddenly ripped away from her by the decree of a king. We know that Queen Vashti was rebellious, and so he removed her from being queen, and he was going to find a new queen. He's going to have an ultimate beauty pageant, basically, for who would be the new queen. Let's turn to Esther 2 and verse 7. Esther 2 and verse 7. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. So whatever comfort she had in living with her cousin, you know, that was taken away. She already lost her father, her mother, and now whatever comfort she had with her new living arrangement, that is being taken away from her. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her in as her own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young women pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women, so basically a harem. And Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. Every day Mordecai placed in front of the court of the women's quarters, in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. So we'll stop here for a second too. You know, put yourself in Esther's shoes. Why am I here? Why is this happening to me? Why have I been taken from my home? Why did the king's agents take me to the house of women, to the harem? Even if I am in the best place in the house of the women, what good is that? Why can't I have one loving husband? Why am I surrounded by rivals for the king's affection? And then the fourth example I'd like to look at is in John 9 and verse 1. As we think about this, we think about their frame of reference, what it was. And it was very limited at the time, but in each of these situations, there was a lot more that was taking place, and it was for a reason. John 9 and verse 1. John 9 and verse 1. Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Okay, let's stop here now. Physically, he can't see at all. He has no vision. He could see nothing. What was his frame of reference mentally and what he was going through? Even Christ's disciples asked whose sin caused his situation. So what do you think the public opinion was of him at that time? If Christ's own disciples were asking this, if that was a concern, well, what's his problem? He must have sin, or his family has sin, his grandfather or his father or mother. No doubt, this blind man, who is a beggar, had a bad reputation. What was on his mind? Why doesn't anyone have a kind word for me? Possibly that was what he was thinking. How long will my family continue to support me with what little I have to contribute from my begging? What happens if they disown me? How will I live then? Was I born in sin? Whose sin was it? Was it mine? Was it my parents' sin, grandparents? Are all the awful things I hear spoken about me true? So we have four stories centuries apart, and no apparent connection to each except for one simple common thread weaving through each scenario. And the question we should think about in all four stories, was God in charge? Was God in charge? Did any of these accounts, any of these stories, these lives, happen by accident? Was there ever a time in any of them when God was not in charge? Was there a single moment that passed by without his knowledge or permission for the events to happen as they did? Of course not. There was purpose in each of these lives. God knew all that was going on, and he fulfilled each specific reason according to his purpose and according to his detailed plan. The other common thread in the four stories is that initially none of the individuals had the true viewpoint and the frame of reference that was really taking place, the big picture. They did not understand all of the very specific reasons that their lives were the way they were. But later on, God provided them a new frame of reference, a wider view, a bigger picture. And that was a key to their understanding and a key for the faith. But it wasn't until God revealed that to them, until he revealed the right frame of reference. Then, oh, okay, that makes a lot more sense now. But in the moment, it can make no sense. It can feel as though the world is at a standstill and you're there and nothing is changing, nothing is moving, trapped in a pit, sitting on an ash heap, isolated in a harem, or blind in need of help. Each feeling like their world, their life, is at a standstill. They don't understand why. Ironically, the phrase, "the day the earth stood still," is a phrase that has become a metaphorical expression to describe moments of great magnitude, a great specific importance or crisis that has taken place. And it implies that a major event or revelation has occurred to bring about a profound change or a shift in perspective, a new frame of reference. That really, if the earth stood still, we would all really take notice, because the earth is traveling at about 66,000 miles per hour. If that abruptly stopped, our frame of reference would change dramatically. But as earthlings, it's easy to believe that we're standing still. We don't feel like we're racing through space at this time, yet we are. Are you and I dizzy at the moment because we're traveling so fast, whirling around the sun at roughly 66,000 miles per hour? Anyone feeling dizzy? Anybody feel unbalanced? No, you don't, because the earth is doing the same thing. And from what we can see and feel from our frame of reference, the world, it appears that it's stationary. It appears that the universe is doing all the moving. The frame of reference can make all the difference in the world. The frame of reference is not a phrase we use often, but it's a comment or a concept that we use nearly every day. You know, it comes into play with observations like, I'm going 5 miles an hour faster than the car next to me. Frame of reference in that situation is you're going faster than the car. Or I'm going 15 miles per hour over the speed limit. And then the next thought is the police officer with the lights flashing is approaching me at a rapid speed compared to where I'm at. You know, it's gaining on me. That's the frame of reference. Speed requires a frame of reference. You can't be just going 75 miles an hour. You have to be going 75 miles an hour in relationship to something else. Here on planet Earth, our frame of reference is the planet's surface. And that's why when the police officer pulls you over and asks you how fast you were going, you don't say, faster than the other guy, slower than you, or 66,000 miles per hour in respect to the sun, so what's another 15 at this point? That's not the response he's looking for. He's asking how fast you're going in relationship to the surface of the earth. Oh, well, why didn't you say so, right? Because we don't talk like that. It's a given. He doesn't just say the last part because it's implied. But imagine if the highway displayed signs that said speed limit, 70 miles per hour in relationship to the surface of the earth. Here's another question. Will my nose stop itching? No. Another question. Does what we see or experience, our frame of reference, make the speed at which the earth is traveling around the sun irrelevant? Just because it's our perspective, does that mean that the other perspective that is out there is just totally irrelevant? Again, imagine if the earth stopped and you didn't. You would quickly see that 66,000 miles per hour is a number that's relevant to your life. And you quickly would understand why that matters a great deal. So we do recognize that there are multiple frames of reference even taking place now, but we really aren't geared towards thinking that way. We usually don't keep track of the multiple frames of reference that are out there. We're not wired that way. And unless you're a physics teacher or a rocket scientist, you probably have little reason to think about those perspectives on a regular basis. But day in and day out, our limited frame of reference, what we see, what we experience, what we focus on, it could persuade us that we are on a stationary planet, that being Earth, and that Earth remains perfectly still while the universe slowly rolls around overhead. The truth of the matter is that we live on a massive organic spaceship whirling its way around a star nestled within a galaxy, traveling at an unfathomable speed through an ever-expanding universe. So that's the truth of the matter, but it's a different reference point. It's a bit harder to wrap our mind around, but yet it's true. So now let's get back to our friends from Scripture, and let's look at their situation from a different frame of reference, that being the bigger purpose for their lives. Joseph was in a pit for a purpose. Ditto for Job on the ash heap. Esther in the king's harem, and the blind man begging on the side of the road. All of them had a purpose. Yet from their vantage point, didn't each situation appear hopeless? Wouldn't you or I be asking, why me? Why is this taking place? Why is God allowing this? Does he care? Has he forgotten me? Am I forsaken? But as readers of God's word, you have more information. And as Paul Harvey would say, you have the rest of the story. In Joseph's case, we have very specific information. We know that the picture only became clear to him after 22 years. So he was sold as a slave at age 17, but in prison after serving Potiphar and brought before Pharaoh at age 30. And then 7 years went by, and then 2 years of famine. So at age 39, when facing his brothers, he got it. He understood. You think about some of the trials and tests that we go through in this life, the tests of patience, where we don't understand. We wonder why. And we're thinking, I don't think I can take another day of not understanding why. And in Joseph's life, it was, how about another 22 years? And then you'll understand why. Genesis 45 and verse 1, but he did finally understand. And what a blessing it would have been for him to finally see a different reference point and understand the bigger picture. That frame of reference was so valuable to him. Genesis 45 and verse 1. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him. He's about to meet his brothers be revealed to his brothers. And he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. Could you imagine? Now can you imagine being in their shoes? Oh, oh boy. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near me. So they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. This was a part of God's plan. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you and the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. What an amazing conclusion. And that was also a wonderful blessing for Israel as well, because for so long, his frame of reference was not the right frame of reference. They were able to meet again. What a wonderful blessing for them all. Go over a chapter to Genesis 46 in verse 1. They were united. But this was very eye-opening for Jacob, for Israel, you know, because he was basically in disbelief at first, but after he understood it was not a lie, he was revived, and then he was able to meet Joseph before he died and was excited to do so. Genesis 46 and verse 1, so Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. So he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. They were reunited as a family, and then later on, after Jacob died, Joseph was able to bury his father and reassure his brothers as well. They were fearful that Joseph would be very angry with him, and now that he died, now what would his true colors really come out? But he comforted them, he forgave them, and it was a positive thing moving forward. God was with Joseph every step of the way. And what about the others? For Job, the pieces didn't make sense until God answered out of a whirlwind. His humility before God showed when he understood. Let's turn to James 5 and verse 10. An interesting tidbit that we have, one regarding Job's life, but more so from the perspective that God had for Job from the beginning. James 5 and verse 10. James 5 and verse 10, my brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed to endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. We see what God's plan was for Job all along. He had a plan. There was the end intended by the Lord, which means there was a beginning in which he also intended for him too, but he knew the end from the beginning. But how hard it would be for Job to see that, and it was really impossible for him to see that without God intervening. It was impossible for his friends too. His friends come around and is basically like the blind man. What sins does he have? And you remember what Job said, you know, woe, miserable comforters you are, you know. But his life was in shambles, and their frame of reference was weak. What about Esther? Her cousin Mordecai's famous question in Esther 4 and verse 14 holds a key to understanding the purpose of her situation. Esther 4 and verse 13 and 14, it says, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And that was the question. This is your story, and this was not by accident. And clearly that was Esther's story. And then what about the blind man? Even Jesus Christ's disciples, you know, asked, whose sin was this for the blind man? And Christ then shattered a cultural misconception with verse 3. Let's turn back to John 9 and verse 1. We'll read that again. John 9 and verse 1. Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Verse 3, Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. As we know, he healed him, and what an incredible incident that would have been to show the works of God. An amazing healing that would have shaken the community to its core. None of these amazing stories happen by accident. So what's the story of your life? What's the story of my life? Are they happening by accident? Do all the pieces make sense to us yet? Probably not. Now you think about when you do a jigsaw puzzle and you start off putting those puzzles in place. A lot of times you don't know how it's going to turn out quite yet or where they go. But, you know, about halfway you have a much better view, and then those pieces really fall into place. But a lot of times it's towards the end. And that can be the same way, really, with all of our lives. Sometimes it's not until the very end, and for some it won't be until the resurrection. Certain questions and understanding for why. It may not be in this life at all. But we are reminded that God is the master potter, and we are the clay. And God always knows the best time to reveal that right frame of reference. When to take action, when not to take action. Just as we're told in the book of Romans, Romans 9 and verse 21. Romans 9 and verse 21. Let's back it up in verse 20. But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Basically to question him. Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? Does not the potter have power over the clay? From the same lump to make one vessel for honor and another for dishonor. What if God, wanting to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had prepared beforehand for glory, even us whom he called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. And God is working with all people, and at whatever point that he calls them to repentance, and whatever point he decides to be merciful, it's in his hands. God has the power over the clay. He has the power over everyone's calling, and the timing for honor is in God's hand. He knows the best timing for everything, and so we must trust God in the process. And really, that's the main question in the entire process. Do we trust him? Do we trust him? Or do we question God, like in verse 20? Or do we trust him and trust that he knows the best frame of reference and always has the best frame of reference, and he'll help us see what he wants us to see in due time? It's a part of building faith, and it's a part of the process that he started with each one. One final scripture to conclude, Hebrews 11 and verse 1. memory scripture that we have. Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is for the times when our frame of reference is limited, when we can't see, when we don't understand what is going on. Faith is the substance of the things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That's a statement, that's an understanding that the people in the four examples never read because they lived those words. That was their life. The path to second in command in Egypt began in a pit. The path to a deeper relationship with God started on an ash heap. The path to royalty and the rescue of the Jews began in a harem. The path to a revelation of God's incredible power and perfect will began with sightless eyes. When these stories began, the end was clear to no one but God. When they ended, the value of every moment along the way became obvious. We may not fully understand our path until it's over, and that's okay. We don't have to right now. God knows, and that needs to be enough for us. Our stories are not happening by accident.